Think about the last time you were totally stuck at work, or maybe staring at this incredibly complex assignment for school.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there.
Right. And you just chose to suffer in silence rather than like raise your hand or send a quick email to ask for help.
Because it feels safer in the moment. You
Yeah.
just want to protect your pride.
Exactly. But the data actually shows that exact instinct, protecting your pride, it increases your risk of career burnout by 34%.
Which is a huge number.
It is. So today we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating stack of research to show you why asking for help isn't some, personal failure or weakness. It's actually a strategic superpower.
It's a profound shift in perspective, really. And we are pulling from a great array of sources today to get there. We've got behavioral science journals from the Decision Lab, corporate coaching models from Highbridge Academy, and the Happy Mondays Come.
And some really practical educational toolkits too, like stuff from Edutopia and these amazing specialized self-advocacy scripts from Dr. Pooky Knight-Smith.
Right. The mission here is to basically shortcut your path to becoming a master self-advocate.
Because before we can get into the exact mechanics of like how you should be asking for help, we kind of have to look at the invisible psychological traps that keep your mouth shut in the first place.
Oh,
And
absolutely.
that usually starts with this phenomenon called the illusion of transparency.
What's fascinating here is how incredibly common this is. The illusion of transparency is this cognitive bias where we just drastically overestimate how much other people can perceive our internal thoughts or, our anxieties.
We think everyone can read our minds.
Exactly. We assume our inner panic is just radiating outward for everyone in the room to see.
I like to think of it like we're playing poker, and we are utterly convinced that our cards are facing outward for everyone at the table to look at.
Right. You think everyone knows your exact hand.
But they don't. They really don't. But if high achievers are so smart and strategic, shouldn't they logically realize that no one is actually reading their minds?
Well, the underlying mechanics of why we do this are rooted in what behavioral scientists call the egocentric bias.
Egocentric bias, okay.
Yeah. Basically, our brains are processing millions of sensory inputs every second. And to save energy, the brain relies on heuristics, which are mental shortcuts.
Like taking the path of least resistance.
Right, because actually practicing empathy, like simulating another person's blank mental slate to understand what they don't know, that requires burning actual glucose in your prefrontal cortex. It is cognitively expensive.
Oh, wow. So it literally takes physical energy to see things from someone else's perspective.
Yes. So the brain takes the cheaper energy route. It just assumes everyone else shares your current context and perceives exactly what you perceive.
That makes the Stanford tapping experiment make so much more sense. The sources highlight this classic 1990 experiment by Elizabeth Newton, a Stanford doctoral
Well,
student.
this one is such a perfect illustration.
It really is. So she divided people into tappers and listeners. The tappers had to tap out the rhythm of a famous song, like Happy Birthday on a table.
Is tapping the beat.
Right, just tapping. And the listeners just had to guess the song. But before they started, the tappers predicted the listeners would guess correctly about 50% of the time.
50%. And what was the actual success rate?
30%.
3%. Wow. That gap between 50% and 3% is the exact space where all of our communication breaks down.
Because the tappers are hearing the full orchestra in their heads, they hear the melody, the sweeping strings, the lyrics.
They're suffering from the curse of knowledge. They are physically unable to unhear the song in their own minds to simulate the listener's perspective.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the listener is just sitting there hearing this bizarre, disjointed series of taps on a desk.
And this translates directly to professional anxieties. We see this in the research from the Decision Lab. They share a case study of a woman named Priya who is giving this really high-stakes presentation.
Oh, I read this. She is sweating. Her heart is racing.
Yeah, she's entirely convinced the whole room can see her falling apart.
No.
Like, if an executive looks at his phone, she immediately assumes, oh, he spotted my incompetence.
Right. She thinks he's bored or judging her.
But in reality, that executive is just responding to an urgent email. The audience actually sees a confident presenter. They are so engrossed in their own internal worlds, they are entirely unaware of her panic.
So, knowing that the anxiety is mostly in our heads should logically free us to ask for help more often, right? Especially those high achievers we were talking about.
You would think so. You'd think they would look at the data, realize no one is reading their minds, and just ask for the resources they need.
But the data from Highbridge Academy shows the exact opposite. 76% of professionals avoid seeking help specifically for fear of appearing incapable.
76%. That is wild.
And this trap is stickiest for high achievers. Because they have built their entire identity around equating independence with competence.
Right. Their internal narrative is, I got to this level by figuring things out on my own. So asking for help breaks my winning formula.
But the cost of that assumption is just brutal. Those high achievers who refuse to ask for help, they face that 34% higher risk of burnout we mentioned earlier.
And they hit early career plateaus because they simply refuse to delegate or collaborate with anyone.
It makes perfect sense that we want to protect our professional image, but that visceral fear of raising a hand, it feels deeper than just wanting a promotion. There is a real emotional weight to it.
Oh, absolutely. And that emotional weight usually forms in childhood. The sources reference Brené Brown's research on school shame, which Morgane Michael touches on in her work.
Right, the school trauma.
Yeah. Brown found that about 85% of people can recall a shaming event in school that permanently altered how they view themselves as learners.
85% is heartbreaking.
It really is. She shares this example of a little girl named Susie. The teacher is handing out graded papers and says, "Who didn't get one?" Susie raises her hand. And the teacher, in front of the entire class, says, "I'm not surprised," and writes the word stupid on Susie's paper.
Oh my gosh, that is permanent damage. You don't just shake that off.
No, you don't. It creates a foundational trauma. It establishes this really toxic power dynamic where vulnerability is intrinsically linked to danger.
Like if you admit you don't know something, you are handing your pride over to someone who has the power to crush it.
Exactly. And you carry that dynamic from the third grade classroom straight into the corporate boardroom.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because we see how this fear of looking incompetent plays out in high stakes, real world crucibles, you know, moments where we desperately need an intervention, but we just freeze up entirely.
Oh, the Macy's story.
Yes. There's this perfect case study of this in the youth communication curriculum. It's a story written by a young man named Sharif Berkeley about his absolutely disastrous first day working at Macy's.
His story, Rush Hour at Macy's, is honestly a masterclass in the anatomy of a panic spiral.
It really is. So Sharif is originally trained for the electronics department, where he knows the inventory inside out. But there's a scheduling mix-up, and he gets thrown into housewares.
Right next to the clearance section.
Exactly. And it's 5:00 p.m. The store is packed. And right away, a customer brings up three clearance items that ring up as 1 cent each.
Which he knows is a system error.
Right. So he has to call his manager to get the real price. But by the time he gets back, the line has multiplied. Then a customer hands him a personal check.
Oh, no.
And his automatic check reader is broken, meaning he has to manually type in the routing numbers.
Which requires intense focus, something you do not have when your cortisol levels are spiking.
Right. He starts sweating profusely. He completely forgets everything from his 15-hour cashier training course. He actually describes the impatient customers staring at him as grim reapers ready to end his life on the spot.
That is terrifying.
It's like he's treading water with a cramp. And the lifeguards are standing right there on the deck, but he refuses to wave his hand because he's embarrassed he forgot how to swim.
He is totally paralyzed by the illusion of transparency. He feels like a profound failure and assumes the customers are judging his core worth, when the reality is they just want to pay for their pots and pans and go home.
Yeah, they don't care about him personally.
Not at all. But the turning point in his story is critical because he doesn't actually manage to ask for help.
Right. Someone else steps in.
Yeah. Another cashier notices him freezing, takes pity, and intervenes. She just turns to the grumpy crowd and announces, "Hey, everyone, it's his first day."
And instantly, the tension just evaporates. The customers' faces soften into compassion. They actually start comforting him.
Yeah.
Sharif noted that his wounds of disappointment were covered by a, quote, band-aid of confidence. Just knowing he had backup allowed his nervous system to regulate. He eventually became so skilled, he wrote, he could process customers like water.
But here's the thing. Relying on a benevolent coworker to notice your silent panic is not a sustainable strategy.
No, definitely not.
Edutopia's educational materials point out that the very first active step in self-advocacy is recognizing your own struggle and intentionally overriding that urge to say, "I want to be independent."
Which is so hard to do in the moment.
It is. But if we look at Sharif's situation through the lens of Highbridge Academy's 5-Y technique, we can really see where the communication broke down.
Oh, I actually use the 5-Y technique with my own team. You basically just keep asking why to drill past the surface panic down to the actual broken gear.
Exactly. Walk me through it for Sharif.
Okay. So for Sharif, the surface problem is panic. Why is he panicking? Because the customers are angry. Why are they angry? Because the line is stopped. Why is the line stopped? Because he can't process the check. Why? Because the machine is broken and he forgot the manual override sequence.
Precisely. Sharif did not lack overall competence. He lacked a mechanism to communicate his specific localized roadblock. If he had been trained on how to articulate that exact root problem to his manager the moment the check reader failed, the panic spiral never would have started.
Which means we need to look at how we construct those requests. Because this isn't just about writing a polite email, you know? It's about reducing the cognitive load on the person you are asking for help.
Absolutely.
So if Sharif's root problem was just poor communication, what exactly should he have said to his manager in that moment?
It really comes down to using a highly structured formula. Our sources provide a phenomenal help request formula designed for emails, Slack messages, and technical issues. It just strips away the emotion and delivers pure utility.
Okay, I love a good formula. What is it?
It has four parts: context, effort, problem, question.
Context, effort, problem, question. We can actually see why this matters by looking at the poor email example from the sources.
Oh, this one hurts to read.
It's so bad. It simply reads, subject.help. Hi, I don't get it, and it's due tonight. Can you help me?
Yeah, when you send an email like that, you are transferring all of the intellectual and emotional labor onto the helper.
Right, they have to do all the work.
They now have to play detective. They have to interrogate you to find out what project you mean, what you've tried, what your timeline is. You have turned a quick favor into a frustrating, open-ended project.
But contrast that with the good email example from a student stuck on a Linux lab assignment. They use that four-part formula perfectly.
Let's hear it.
Okay, context. I'm trying to set file permissions so the owner can read and write, but others have no permissions. Effort. I ran the command schmod 640 and rebooted the virtual machine twice. Problem. The other section is still showing read permission. Question. Is there something I'm missing about how this command works, or is the Ubuntu environment overriding it?
See, that is handing the helper a solvable puzzle instead of a burden.
Exactly.
And the Highbridge Academy corporate coaching model uses a really similar three-sentence rule for workplace requests. Problem, impact, request.
Three sentences. Simple.
Very. First sentence, I've completed the data import but can't generate the variance report. Second sentence, if we don't fix this, we can't present the accurate financials tomorrow. Third sentence, could you walk me through the generation process by Thursday at 2 p.m.?
Okay, wait. I'm stuck on one of the specific rules Highbridge includes in that formula. They suggest you should always list three things you have already tried before asking for help.
Yes, the rule of three.
But if I walk up to my boss and hand them a laundry list of all my failed attempts, aren't I just providing documented proof that I'm incompetent? It feels like I'm highlighting my mistakes.
This raises an important question, and it's the exact trap most high achievers fall into. But there is a brilliant reframe in the sources from a McKinsey partner.
What do they say?
They state, failed attempts aren't failures, they're data points.
Oh, I like that. Data points.
Right. When you list the three things you tried, you are actually signaling competence. You're proving that you are resourceful and that you respect their time enough not to treat them like a basic search engine.
Yeah, you're doing the legwork.
Practically, you are saving the helper from wasting their breath, suggesting troubleshooting steps you have already exhausted.
Looking at failed attempts as data points just completely changes the dynamic. You are presenting your research, not confessing a sin.
Exactly.
The sources also emphasize being hyper-specific about deadlines, which ties right back into reducing that cognitive load. And they say, never use the acronym ASAP.
Never. Because ASAP is entirely subjective. It creates immediate friction.
Right. To me, ASAP means drop everything, the building is on fire. To the person I'm asking, it might mean, oh, sometime before the end of the quarter when my calendar clears up.
Exactly. You have to anchor the request, say, by Thursday at 2 p.m., precision removes friction.
And once the help is provided, there is one final critical step. The 24-hour thank you rule.
Oh, this is huge for relationship building.
You must follow up within 24 hours. But a simple thanks isn't enough. You need to share the outcome. Tell them, I used your advice, the command worked perfectly, and the client approved the final report.
Because humans are wired to want to see the impact of their generosity. Showing them the tangible result of their help builds immense long-term relationship capital.
Those structured formulas are incredibly effective for, you know, asynchronous communication like an email or a Slack message. But when you are face-to-face in a meeting, the actual words we use carry a really heavy emotional weight.
Very true.
We can't just recite a four-part formula like a robot. We need to navigate the interpersonal dynamics, and that requires stripping away apologies.
iBridge Academy is adamant about this.
Right.
We have to stop shrinking ourselves when we ask for assistance.
Yes.
When you walk up to a colleague and say, I'm so sorry to bother you or hate to be a pain, but you are framing the entire interaction as you begging for a rescue.
Right. You're putting yourself down.
You are placing yourself in a subordinate, victimized position. If you shift your language to, I'd really value your input on this, you fundamentally alter the dynamic. You aren't a burden. You are a professional inviting collaboration.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We have these incredible self-advocacy scripts from Dr. Pookie Knightsmith.
I love her work.
It's so good. They were specifically designed to help autistic girls navigate overwhelming sensory and academic environments in school. But reading through them, they are universally applicable tools for anyone whose brain just freezes up when they need to speak out loud.
Because they are built on a sliding scale of intensity, which allows you to choose a script that matches your current cognitive capacity.
Right.
If you have the energy to be polite, you can use the gentle approach. You say, I'm finding this tricky. Could you explain it another way?
Okay.
But if you are more depleted, you shift to the direct approach.
Hmm.
I need help with this specific part.
And if you are entirely hitting a wall, there is the assertive approach. I've tried to figure this out, but I'm stuck. I need you to go over it with me.
And they even include nonverbal options, like holding up a pre-made help card, which is a brilliant bypass for when you are so overwhelmed that you literally cannot formulate speech.
Knightsmith's work also deeply emphasizes that managing sensory overload is a prerequisite for cognitive function.
Yes, you cannot process complex information if your nervous system is under attack.
Exactly. So a student or an employee needs the language to set boundaries, like saying, the noise in here is a bit much. Can I sit somewhere quieter to finish this?
It's so important to have those scripts ready.
But I do have a pushback here. If I'm the most junior person in the room, say a brand new intern, I can't exactly look at the CEO and assertively say, I need you to go over it with me. That feels like a fast track to getting fired.
Well, which is why you always have to measure your request against your relationship capital.
Relationship capital.
Yeah. You tailor the ask to the dynamic. If you are junior, you lean heavily on the 15-minute favor.
Okay. What's that?
Asking a senior executive for a massive open-ended mentorship project requires a lot of capital. But asking them for a highly targeted 15-minute review of a specific methodology, that requires very little.
Oh, that makes sense.
And regarding boundaries, we really have to culturally reframe them. Setting a boundary to protect your focus is a form of self-care and professional responsibility. It's not rudeness.
And if you are still feeling incredibly shy or intimidated, Edutopia offers the ultimate bypass. It's a two-words trick.
Just two words.
Yeah. You don't need a whole paragraph. You don't need to explain the whole problem while you're actively stressed. Just walk up to your manager or teacher and say, I'm struggling.
I love that.
Those two words act like a flare gun. They signal the need for intervention without demanding a massive cognitive output from you in your most vulnerable moment.
But we do have to address the structural reality here.
Yeah.
We can arm an individual with all the psychological insights and perfectly engineered scripts in the world. But if their school or corporate environment is toxic, asking for help will always feel like a threat to their survival.
Right. If leadership routinely punishes vulnerability, no perfectly crafted email formula is going to save you. So what does this all mean? How do we actually fix the environments themselves? How do organizations build cultures where help flows naturally and the stigma is just neutralized?
It requires engineering systems that force help seeking to become the cultural default.
Cool.
One of the most fascinating examples in the sources is the reciprocity ring. It was developed by organizational psychologist Adam Grant.
Oh, this concept is brilliant. So you get a group of about eight people together. Every single person goes around the circle and is required to make one specific request for something they need help with.
Required. That's the key.
Right. Then the rest of the group pools their resources, networks, and knowledge to fulfill those requests.
And the reason it works so well psychologically is that it completely neutralizes the power imbalance.
Yeah, because everyone's doing it.
Exactly. When the rules of the game mandate that everyone must ask for something, asking is no longer a signal of weakness or incompetence. It is simply compliance with the system.
That is so smart.
And The data shows that organizations utilizing these giver cultures don't just solve isolated problems. They see higher overall profitability, better customer satisfaction, and significantly lower employee turnover.
Another amazing cultural practice comes from Zingerman's, the famous food company in Michigan. When a new leader is inducted, they hold a public event where everyone in attendance states exactly how they're going to contribute to that new leader's success.
It preloads a support network.
Exactly. So when that leader inevitably hits a wall 3 months later, they don't have to awkwardly figure out who to ask. They already have a public commitment from their team.
We see this mirrored in educational settings, too. Educopia highlights the use of expertise boards in classrooms.
I wish we had these when I was in school.
Right. Every student and the teacher list two or three things they're an expert at. It could be state capitals, spelling, or, you know, drawing dinosaurs.
Whatever their thing is.
By ensuring everyone is recognized as a helper with unique value, you flatten the hierarchy. It becomes much easier to be the one asking for help when you know you are also a resource for others.
And Forbes reinforces this for the corporate world, too. They advise leaders to actively use weekly staff meetings to ask their own employees for help, modeling that vulnerability from the absolute top down.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you might be thinking that shifting an entire corporate culture requires you to be the CEO or the principal.
Yeah, can a regular person actually start something like this?
Absolutely. You can create a psychological safe space locally, just within your immediate team of three or four people. By offering your help to others first and doing it without keeping a transactional scorecard, you prove that generosity isn't a scarce resource. It is highly contagious.
We have covered a massive amount of ground in this deep dive. We looked at how the brain's desire to conserve energy leads to the illusion of transparency, tricking us into thinking everyone can see our hidden struggles. We unpacked the cognitive architecture of the perfect ask. Context, effort, problem, question. We explored how to upgrade your language from apologizing to collaborating, and how tools like the reciprocity ring can systemize a culture of generosity.
But there's one final, really fascinating dimension to this that we have to consider, drawing directly from the Decision Lab's insights on human behavior.
Okay, lay it on us.
We're entering an era where artificial intelligence is rapidly becoming our primary collaborator. But the paradox is, we are already treating AI like it can read our minds.
Oh, it's so true. We type a vague two-word prompt into a chatbot, and when the supercomputer spits out something generic or unhelpful, we get intensely frustrated.
Yes, we are literally falling for the illusion of transparency with a machine. We expect it to know our context, our unspoken tone, and our specific goals just because we know them.
That is wild.
If we're struggling to effectively ask a literal machine for help because we mistakenly assume it shares our internal context, It is staggering to think about how much unnecessary friction we are creating with the complex human beings around us.
That is a profound point. So Next time you are sitting in silence, staring at a screen, completely lost and choosing to suffer, Next time you are drafting a request for help, whether it is to a human colleague or an AI assistant, pause and ask yourself, am I expecting them to read my mind?